pleased to introduce our next invited speaker, Dr. Sylvina Montreul from the University of Illinois, and she's going to speak to us about dominance in attrition, multilingualism, and the science of learning and forgetting.
Well, thank you very much for Carsten for inviting me. Here you are. And for me, I did my PhD here, graduated in 1998. I studied in the linguistics department, so it's a very I'm very happy to be here in a different way. It's also a lot of high pressure for me to do this, but I guess I'm going to tell you what I learned since I left as a graduate student here. And I have not thrown away my training. It has evolved, so that's what I'm going to show you. And my training was in linguistics and second language acquisition, but when I moved back to the United States, I found a different situation, and that's what I'm going to be telling you about. So two assumptions about language knowledge that I learned when I was a grad student here at McGill. First, the language acquisition by normally developing children is uniform, universal, and successful. That is to say, every normally developing child reaches full linguistic competence. They become what we call an adult native speaker. And once acquired, native language competence is stable. Now, in a bilingual situation, like, and especially in Montreal, it's very common, perhaps, or we can find speakers who are able to develop two languages fully from birth into adulthood. Although, of course, the two languages are never equal all the time because we use them for different purposes. So, but in other bilingual situations, and especially the ones that I'm interested in, especially the children of immigrants, what we call in the United States heritage speakers, and this is a term that actually started in Canada but has been used in the United States a lot, these children are exposed to two languages from birth or in early childhood and do not always attain full linguistic competence in the family language when they reach adulthood. So if you look at, they may start as bilinguals and balanced, but by the time they are 18 or when they get to the university, this is when we study them, they are not fully competent in the heritage language. And also adults with more than 10 years of immigration in a second language environment, immigrants can experience first language attrition, namely forgetting lexical and grammatical aspects of their native language. And again, these are not guaranteed outcomes. They are something that happens, but it doesn't happen to everybody, okay? Now, it's also important when we talk about bilingualism to discuss a little bit the concept of dominance. So dominance is, when you're talking about dominance, you have to take into account the two languages. It's a relative term. It's one language is dominant with respect to the other. And this includes a component of proficiency, which we usually measure. It can include textual, grammatical, phonological, and lexical ability, and also fluency and processing speed. But there are also other variables that contribute to dominance, which are biographical variables, for example, the age of acquisition, place of birth and place of residence, and languages of the environment. And then input and use, of course, how much you use or hear the language, the type of context, where you hear the language, and how much you use it, okay? And this can be dissociated. So proficiency and dominance usually are taken as equivalent in a lot of research, but they are not totally, they can be dissociated. And actually, there's a book coming out by Cambridge University Press, edited by Silva Corvalan and Treffers Dallers on precisely this topic of disentangling dominance and proficiency and how to measure it, okay? But in situations of language contact, bilinguals usually acquire and use their languages for different purposes in different domains of life with different people, and different aspects of life require different languages. This is Grosjean, 2008. So bilingual balance and dominance are reflections of the complementarity principle. That's what Grosjean says. So this is the complementarity principle. If you think about a French-English bilingual here in Canada, you might use French only in certain contexts, like in red, and then you use English in specific contexts, and then there are other contexts where you use the two languages. So your proficiency in the two languages can be a function, especially if you're going to measure lexicon. It's going to be a function of where you use your languages. For example, my native language is Spanish, but very soon I have to give a similar talk in Spanish. I'm freaking out because I only work in English, so I'm not used to talking about these things in Spanish that often. So my languages are also compartmentalized, okay? So what are the consequences of this? The level of fluency attained in a language will depend on the need for the language and will often be domain-specific. So if reading and writing skills are not needed, they will not be developed in certain cases. And if a language is not needed in a context or for a purpose, the vocabulary and linguistic properties associated with the context or purpose will not be developed. So when we're talking about heritage speakers, again, if you read articles on this topic, you will find that the first two or three paragraphs are devoted to defining who are these people. But this is a sociolinguistic definition. That is to say, one of the languages of these bilinguals is a minority language, sociopolitically speaking. But within this group, we have different psycholinguistic profiles. And that's what is making the study of this population. You have to really define your speakers when you're talking about them. So within this group, we find simultaneous bilinguals, that is to say children who were exposed to the majority language and the minority language at the same time. But you also have sequential bilinguals, they were described in one of the talks today, children who are basically raised mostly monolingually in the home until age 4 or 5, and then they start exposure to the second language, the majority language, when they go to school. And then we have the children who immigrate in mid-childhood. That's another group. So we have immigrant children and children of immigrants, and they are different. So the immigrant child already might have some schooling in the native country, and then they have to start schooling in the majority language. And so far, this topic has been, social linguistics has dealt with this population for many years, but most recently, theoretical linguistics and psycholinguistics have become interested in this group. So I think, honestly, we all need to work together on this. So going back to bilingual balance, what happens in these children is that there's language shift in childhood. The first and primary language becomes the second and secondary language by early adulthood. Okay? And if you look at the generation, what happens in the family, so for example, the parents arrive in the country, they're usually non-native speakers of the majority language, but they are native speakers of their first language. They are dominant in their native language. But what I have been interested is in the children, the second generation, most of them are dominant in the majority language. I'm talking about the United States in particular. And then what happens with the heritage language, you find the whole range of proficiency, from very low receptive to very high. And then if you go to the third generation, they are still very dominant in the majority language, and then proficiency in the heritage language is even lower. You will find at most intermediate proficiency, those who were able to keep it, but some of them don't even speak the language anymore. So here's to show you how, again, in this case, these are the types of heritage speakers that we find with respect to bilingual balance. They are all, in general, the ones I have studied all these years tend to be native-like in English, the majority language, but the level of proficiency in the heritage language varies significantly. So you might have these people, for example, in El Paso, Texas, which is a bilingual town, you're going to find very high balanced bilinguals. But in other cities, you find this. And of course, I have been interested in this population, and I'll tell you why. Because they come to the second language classroom. They want to learn their language. And this is now a practical problem for the teaching profession, because, so for example, Russian today is mostly Russian for heritage speakers. There's very few people who want to learn Russian as a second language. So basically, the teaching profession had to completely start teaching a different type of learner, and they don't understand, we need to understand what they keep from childhood and what they don't have, because we have to develop new materials. But these are the reasons why they come to the classroom. I would like to improve my writing skills as well as reading.
Also, my speech needs work and my vocabulary is very limited. I want to be grammatically correct. I want to embrace my culture as much as possible, and I feel that I lost a vital part of speaking it while I was growing up. I am weaker in my native language. I don't want to start talking in English when speaking in Hindi. I don't know how to read or write, so I would like to improve that. I also want to improve my speaking ability so that I can be confident if I ever have to speak with a stranger in India. And this comes from a major study I've been conducting with Spanish, Hindi, and Romanian heritage speakers, and these are samples from the questionnaire for how do they feel about their language. So from the Hindi data, this is a typical profile of the speakers we tested. Rakesh, 22 years old, born in the United States to Hindi-speaking parents, very high SES for the Hindi speakers I tested, and he was, of course, totally schooled in English, spoke Hindi at home with the parents. His parents spoke Hindi, but Rajesh used some Hindi and often responded in English. It's a very common pattern in these families. As a 20-year-old, his knowledge of English is native-like in all skills, but knowledge of Hindi is intermediate in spoken and oral comprehension and cannot read and write the language. He's illiterate. So in many languages, we have the issue of the script that is also different. So this is from self-ratings in this study, where you ask these speakers to rate their proficiency in English and all the skills, they are rated very high and they all go together. But in the heritage language, we find lots of dissociations. Usually what we find is that, of course, they have better auditory skills and the worst is writing. And most of the time, of course, as I'll tell you soon, they did not receive schooling in that language either. And this is Hindi native speakers from India that were also asked to do this, and as you can see, they are very bilingual, okay? So what we know so far is that heritage speakers have linguistic gaps in several aspects of their grammar, phonology, lexicon, morphology, syntax, semantics, and pragmatics. But phonology is the best preserved area of linguistic knowledge. Morphology seems to be a particularly vulnerable area in heritage speakers of different languages. And so in one of our studies, we look at, well, case marking is very problematic for languages that have rich case systems. So in this study, we're looking at accusative case, but we also had the opportunity to look at ergative case here because they were asked to retell a story, and we have oral tasks, we have grammaticality judgments, and this is just a sample from an oral narrative task, where Hindi native speakers produce ergative every time they have to produce it, but the Hindi heritage speakers omit it 30% of the time. There's only one study that I found on first language acquisition on Hindi showing that by age 3, Hindi-speaking children do ergative very well, but these 22-year-olds do not, okay? Now, potential causes. The one I have been arguing for is these children do not get enough input to develop the full linguistic system, so there is incomplete acquisition or interrupted acquisition due to this. I'm not the only person who has said this. William O'Grady and Maria Polinsky are also agree on this. But it could also be language attrition during the critical period or different parental input, or language change in progress, or all of the above. We don't know. We have to tease all these apart. So why do I think it is incomplete acquisition? It's because I follow the language learning process, and my logical conclusion is that this is what's going on, but we need more data, of course. So during the preschool years, children acquire their native language, and the basic structural foundation is assumed to be in place. But there's a difference between acquisition and mastery. To achieve native language proficiency or mastery is a long process of development from birth to adulthood. And the people who work on later language development, like Ruth Bergman, holds this position. So if you look at the development of language throughout the lifespan, of course, a lot of people have looked at this period because this is where everything happens and everything emerges at this age. But what I'm telling you today is that we are not done here. Even though a lot of things happen here, this period is so important, especially for these bilingual children. If you do not have language support during this time, what you acquire here can go away. Okay, it's not fully settled. Okay, in middle childhood, of course, you go to school, you develop reading, metalinguistic awareness, but you expand your vocabulary, and you also learn to use productively complex syntax, semantics, pragmatics, and you become aware of registers. So in terms of syntactic knowledge, even though many things emerge early, for example, in Spanish, you can see some subjunctives at age 2 or 3, children do not develop the full range of subjunctive use until they are 12 or 13. So there's a lot of learning or growth that continues in your first language during that period. I recently ran into this study in French. It's monolingual French. But, of course, the passive is something that it's more common in written language. But this study shows that when children, 9-year-olds, do not use passive productively in their speech when they are asked to tell a story, but then 12-year-olds, because they went through schooling and they get input with passive, they start to incorporate them into production. So that means that school is doing something to your language as well. They're providing more input and giving you an opportunity to practice that language and make it part of your productive use. Okay? And so so you acquire your language, but then you need to settle it. And, of course, we know that there is a language acquisition device or universal grammar that plays a role. There's exposure to language is important, but also age is important for language development. And many of you are familiar with the Johnson and Newport study, which was done in my university in 1989. And these are Korean immigrants who, the younger they were when they came to the United States, the better their English, okay? But what happens if you turn this around? If you were to test these Korean immigrants in Korean, then you will find that these are the best in Korean and these are the worst in Korean. So there are also age effects in L1 loss. L2 studies show that immigrant children are able to reach native-like proficiency in the L2 because they were exposed to the L2 early in life. But the downside is that as they gain proficiency in the L2, they lose proficiency in the L1. The L1 ceases to develop at age-appropriate levels, and they are likely to exhibit attrition or incomplete acquisition. And there's a study on pronunciation that shows this, Jenny Comshian, Flegi, and Liu, published in Bilingualism, Language and Cognition. And these are Korean immigrants. This is the native speakers and pronunciation in English. The younger, the better. But this is their Korean. Okay? So the younger, the worst. And then they map the two in terms of Z-scores, and you see that there is a negative correlation between proficiency in the L1 and the L2 for these immigrants. Okay? So what is L1 attrition? Is the loss of linguistic skills under reduced or interrupted input conditions. And for me, the assumption is that in order for you to do something, you need to have it first. Okay? So the best ideal subjects of study for attrition are adults or older children assumed to have acquired the relevant grammatical properties under investigation. And there's going to be a talk after me on that. So the first generation immigrants will be the ones that you need to use to show whether they lost something. And this is what would happen. So maybe they learned a second language before they immigrated, but then after many years of living in an immigration context, their second language continues to grow, but then there's some effects in their L1 starts to dwindle a little bit. And Christina is going to tell us, okay? But what happens with the younger children? Do they really finish acquiring something or do they lose it before they do so? So if the L2 is acquired together with the L1 or before the age of primary linguistic development, the L1 begins to lag behind. The L1 becomes the weaker language. And when these children reach adulthood, they may exhibit incomplete acquisition of the L1. And I'm talking about the second and third generation immigrants. So let's say a simultaneous bilingual child starts very well And there's data showing that some of these children develop very well during this period, but then this is what happens during the school age period. They're not getting input or schooling in that language, and what you get at home is not enough. Then during this period, these children start, they speak English with their friends. It's not cool to speak your native language with your friends, even if they come from the same families, okay? And then some of them may get something in high school, and then they go to university, and they want to catch up everything they didn't get earlier, okay? And then you have the other case of the ones who are monolingual in the heritage language, but then there's shift, okay? So we have the two patterns. And we have age effects in this. The younger the age of onset of bilingualism and disuse of the L1, the greater the loss. And the effects of the L1 attrition in childhood are more severe than in adulthood. That is to say, in adults we see some effects, but I don't think the grammar is totally compromised, but in the children they are. Okay? Okay, and so I've also been studying this phenomenon for many years. It's differential object marking in Spanish. In Spanish, you need if you're talking about an animate specific object, you need this preposition. This is wrong, but this is what the heritage speakers do. And in English, you don't need that. And there are several. So there's a study on first language acquisition of Spanish showing that by age 3, monolingual speaking children control this phenomenon with 85 to 90% accuracy. There's a study coming out in linguistic approaches to bilingualism with simultaneous bilingual children showing that they do not control this. They're only 30% production of this phenomenon. And I have been following this after all this time. 6 to 17-year-old children only produce it 45% of the time. Average, and then the adults, they do a little better, but they don't reach the level of monolingual speakers. Okay, and this is just from one of my studies to show you that there's a lot of variability. Some children do not produce this marker at all, and others have it 100% of the time, and the others are everywhere in between. There's a lot of variability. But in order to trace this, you really need longitudinal studies, so I'm excited that Silva Corvalán finished her study of her grandchildren. She followed her grandchildren for 6 years. And so these were two simultaneous bilingual children. Only one of the parents spoke Spanish. And she looked at the tense aspect and mood system, copulas, and subject expression. And so the children were highly exposed to English. And this is what all the Spanish they got. But one, you see, they are siblings. This is the older one. This is the younger one. So the younger one always gets a little more. But this is what she saw, that up to, even with this amount of input, which is less than 50%, the development until age 3 was balanced for the two children, but after that, it starts to diverge, and the heritage language goes down. So it looks like at this time, that amount of input is enough, but later it is not. And here, in English, the children are able to develop native-like, age-appropriate control of all the verb system, but not in Spanish, for example. Okay. This is my two last slides, and I'm done. So far, in order to look at this phenomenon really well, you really need to do longitudinal studies like Carmen did, looking at people, looking at the two languages. That will be from birth, and we need to follow the school age period, okay? So far, we have done cross-sectional studies comparing heritage speakers to native speakers who are recent arrivals or to L2 learners because we want to understand how they differ from them or to first-generation immigrants. And also, we have studies of heritage speakers and child L1 learners and child and adult heritage speakers. But ideally, we want the longitudinal design. And finally, even though I'm interested in specific linguistic features, this is a phenomenon that it's embedded in multiple levels of complexity. We cannot forget the social-political factors which affect the attitudes and beliefs and the level of education of the speakers, where you get education in that language or not. That, at the same time, influences the amount of language practices, input, and use, which is crucial to develop what's coming down here, and that's what we're interested in. Okay, so what we need are longitudinal studies spanning the entire language development period. a bilingual approach to look at the interrelationship between the two languages along the lifespan, an integration of theoretical linguistics, language acquisition, psycholinguistics, and social linguistics, and of course, other disciplines, because this has implications for language policies, health sciences, education, and other areas. Thank you very much.
I wonder if you can distinguish between narrow syntactic knowledge and the semantic, pragmatic, and so on, reflexes or adumbrations to that knowledge. So is there a way of telling whether it's appropriate conditions of use, full semantics, and so on, of a given structure that the heritage children don't get, or whether it's actually the syntax and morphology that they're not getting? And I'm thinking about determiners in particular, because there's evidence that the syntax is there very, very early, but the semantics, as people like Yonan and Wexler have tried to show, comes much later. So I wonder, to what extent can you tease those things apart?
Yes. Okay, so I think it's very important to understand that there is schedule, you know, for language acquisition. So there are things that are acquired very early that tend to be more resilient than others. So in the specific case of articles, I do have a study with Tanya Yonin, where Spanish and English have articles, but the semantics of the definite article is different. And what we see, and actually we have two studies where we tested the heritage speakers in the two languages, in English and in Spanish. They're completely native-like in English with the right interpretation in English, but they do bear plurals in Spanish, which is ungrammatical, and they also tend to interpret the definite article as specific rather than generic. So there's a lot of transfer at the semantic level, but they do have articles. And then with that error, we see it a lot in writing. They keep doing the bare plurals. And then we tested the second language learners, and there's no difference in this domain. They are exactly like second language learners who speak English and are learning Spanish. But there are other areas, for example, like clitics that I have looked at, that they say it's a very resilient area. I have not found differences with clitics or with WH movement, but semantics of articles, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in terms of the question I asked, then that would suggest that, or do you think that, the syntax is intact, but it's the semantics and the conditions of use that are fragile.
Yes, so for example, they get basic structure. Even there's a study on Swedish saying that they don't lose V2, for example, but gender is a problem. So gender is a big problem. Word order that is different from SVO or topicalizations, what we call recently interfaces, you know, in many areas, that seems to be problematic. But case is very, very vulnerable, for example. Nominal morphology is more vulnerable than verbal morphology.
Okay.
Those are the patterns we are seeing. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your talk, and this is a very important population, so mm-hmm. Thanks for encouraging people to go into it. I see that you emphasize the role of input, even though you admit that that can't explain necessarily the progress and then lack of progress or even reversal of some sort. So I wonder if you have done studies or are interested in doing studies that look more at the role of cross-linguistic influence from the second language, or if that's a factor in how you believe what happens in this population.
It is. So my question has been, what does this incomplete knowledge look like? Okay, and sometimes there are missing elements, and sometimes it's just transfer from the other language. So what I just said about determiners, it's transfer from English, but it doesn't allow them to develop the system for Spanish. So they just go with the English system for the two languages. So in some areas, it looks like plain transfer. In other areas, they just do not develop. If you don't have anything to transfer, maybe some, like, for example, well, the subjunctive in Spanish is something that you cannot transfer from English, so there's simplification. They start to use indicative everywhere. So what you see is simplification or a strong transfer from the other language. And other areas that don't get developed. Mm-hmm.